This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's no secret that our nation is facing an epidemic of opioid addiction and deaths, and no community is immune. But it's also true that some areas have been hit far harder than others. A new investigation in the Journal of the American Medical Association took a county-by-county look at 3 decades of data about deaths related to drug and alcohol abuse, and finds that the picture at the local level can be dramatically different than national statistics might suggest. And spoiler alert, southeastern Massachusetts does not seem to be headed in a good direction with regard to either opioids or alcohol. Ali Mokhtad is one of the authors of that study. He's a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Good morning.
We know that we have an opioid epidemic nationally, and we learned several months ago that opioid overdoses have actually become the leading cause of accidental deaths in people under 50. What does this new investigation add to our understanding of the problem?
This new study shows the variation by county when it comes to mortality from substance abuse, alcohol abuse, homicide, and suicide. So the variation and disparity between one county and another tells you a lot about the epidemic and its spread. And by giving a number for a state or for the nation, for example, you're really giving an average. And we know there are people who are performing much worse or better than that average. And by pointing out what's the problem at the local level, this is when you energize the community and the local authorities to act.
So when it comes to opioid addiction, you found, as the national statistics might have suggested, that there was an increase in every county. But in some places, that increase was 8%. And in other counties, it was 8,000%. Where are those counties? And do we have any handle on why they have seen such an incredible increase in opioid-related deaths?
So several counties have seen over 5,000% increase. In West Virginia, Kentucky, some parts of New Mexico, and mainly parts of that region around Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky. And why it varies, the reasons vary from one location to another. So this study didn't examine the specific causes of that increase, but that increase from other studies is associated with socioeconomic factors such as income, education, and in many times, unfortunately, employment and unemployment in that case.
One thing that struck me in reading through this study is the importance of distinguishing between absolute death rate, the number of people per 1,000 or you know, whatever metric you choose to use that are dying because of opioid overdoses or alcohol abuse, and the increase in the number of people who are dying from those. And those areas in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky that you mentioned, they've got both, right? They've seen a dramatic increase and now have some of the highest absolute death rates. Here in eastern Massachusetts, we've got a slightly different situation where the total number of deaths isn't even in the same league as those areas in southern West Virginia. But the scale of the increase is maybe similar. I mean, what do you take away from that?
So a couple of things that you could take away from that. If you go in the past, it depends where the level of that county is. So where are you starting from? If you're starting from a low number and then the epidemic is sweeping across the nation, so you're more likely to have a high percentage increase because you're catching up with everybody else. The problem is what you mentioned is the double whammy, where people have currently a very high rate and their increase has been one of the sharpest increase that we have seen. And by pointing both numbers, basically we're telling the communities and the public health community mainly that trend is increasing and how fast it's increasing and where your levels are right now in order to set priorities for intervention.
I'm talking with global health researcher Ali Mokhtad of the University of Washington about a new county-by-county analysis of drug and alcohol-related deaths in the U.S. You also looked at alcohol, and here the picture gets even more complicated because overall, at the national level, we've seen a decrease in alcohol abuse-related deaths. but you actually saw an increase in 65% of counties. And you already said, you know, this is the difference between the individual numbers and the average. But if you're seeing an increase in 65% of counties, how can the average possibly be a decrease?
It's the size of the population. Remember, the average is about the size of the population of the whole United States. So that's the number for the U.S. So some of these counties have a smaller population size. And that's why when you look at by county, you see a lot of counties have seen a sharp increase in alcohol.
And again, southeastern Massachusetts doesn't end up with the highest death rates, but is one of those places that has seen a pretty sharp increase in alcohol abuse-related deaths. What do you hope that counties and regions that have these high increase rates, what do you hope they might do with that information?
So we have published before on alcohol consumption, mainly on binge drinking, the excessive drinking, more than 4 drinks per occasion for a female, more than 5 drinks per occasion for a male. And we have seen a sharp increase in the consumption of binge drinking, especially among females. So females are increasing faster the rate of consumption of alcohol than males. So basically, what we would like communities to look at alcohol consumption, not only, unfortunately, in the United States, it's viewed as drinking and driving, but there are more to it. Alcohol is a risk factor for mortality, for morbidity, and it causes a lot of problems from, you know, violence, sometimes unwanted pregnancy, to liver diseases and mortality. And we want community to realize that it's more than just putting in place actions against drinking and driving. We need more policies in order to limit the consumption.
We get a lot of national statistics from our government agencies about health and mortality issues. How much more effort or funding does it take to do these kinds of county by county, really detailed local analyses that as you've said, can be so powerful?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the public health is local, and unless you provide a local community with its number, and in many of these counties, so if you look at the United States, about 3,100 counties or so, many of these counties do not have the capacity to do their own analysis and to produce their numbers. So if you're looking at the big cities like New York City, Seattle, LA, they're able to do their own analysis. They have a strong local department with statisticians and epidemiologists who are able to do so. So providing a number for most of these communities is really a blessing, because now they can document the burden and they can seek funding. And the fact that IHME is going to be doing this on a continuous basis, they could come and say, if you give me funding, you could evaluate what I'm doing. So to answer your question, these analyses are a little bit complicated and they require a lot of time in terms of computational power. And we are lucky here at IHME that we are able, we know the know-how and we have the capacity to produce these numbers. The challenge is getting the numbers on time. We reported 2014, but in 2018. So there is a lag in terms of releasing the data from the U.S. government to make it available for people to do such analysis.
What prompted your center, your institute at University of Washington, to want to try to produce these kinds of numbers and to launch this initiative to be able to do this on, as you said, an ongoing basis and at the request of different localities?
We strongly here believe in the power of data. And, you know, unless you are counting, you're not going to do anything about it. And unless you're able to measure a problem or a public health issue, you're not going to act on it. So we felt that by providing this data, especially for counties who don't have that information, and by showing this huge variation within a state, we could basically trigger the questions and hopefully find the answers. Why? Why is these disparities occurring in a state? Why certain counties are performing better than others? And what should be done here in order to make sure that everybody in the United States achieve a better health and longer life and healthier life? In the U.S., unfortunately, we spend more on health than anybody else in the world. We talk about health. We debate health more than anybody else in the world. But when it looks at our performance compared to other countries in the world, and especially to countries of our own might in terms of economy, we're really falling behind. And it's about time for us in the U.S. to revise what we are doing, go back to the drawing board, and then drop what is not working and start investing in programs that are making an impact. And we feel this data will allow everybody to do so here in the U.S.
Ali Mokhtar is a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington and co-author of a new investigation of county-by-county death rates due to drug and alcohol abuse over the past 3 decades. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Here's a different kind of addiction that's on the rise: social media addiction. Millions of people use social media. Many probably overuse it, and some are actually clinically addicted. But who is most likely to develop a social media problem? We know some of the personality traits that can contribute to substance abuse. Now, new research suggests that neuroticism, conscientiousness, and agreeableness may be important predictors of social media addiction. Isaac Vagefi is assistant professor in the Binghamton University School of Management. Isaac, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
For your most recent study, you worked with 300 college-age students. I'm guessing all of them use social media, but I'm curious how many were addicted and how you draw that line between use and addiction.
That's a good point. So the way we define addiction in this study and in some of my other work is coming from definitions of addiction from clinical psychology. And the way we define addiction is based on the symptoms that users show and how extreme those symptoms are. If I want to give you an example of some of these symptoms, it could be things such as withdrawal, mood modification, conflict. And these are symptoms that should be associated with their technology use. And also we looked at their social network use and how much of negative consequences it has on their life. It could be in terms of their social relationship. It could be in terms of their personal well-being. It could be on their productivity and performance. And a combination of all these is how we define an addiction. So the way we measured it is actually not black and white. Newer research, especially with regard to technology addiction, we see a range of people that start from low addiction to high addiction. But if I want to give you some numbers, I think more than 80% of people fall in the non-problematic threshold or non-problematic healthy level. Although the level of usage is different, but when we talk about significant negative consequences, I think about 15-20% of our samples showed those extreme problems.
You looked at 5 different personality traits that might contribute to those problems, and these are 5 traits that personality researchers commonly use: extroversion, openness to experience, neuroticism, conscientiousness, and agreeableness. And it was those last 3 that you really saw a relationship between those personality traits and a person's likelihood to develop an addiction to social media. So let's start with neuroticism. I mean, we use this word neurotic in common usage all the time, but in a more technical sense, like what is neuroticism as a personality trait and what is its relationship to social media addiction?
It's interesting, actually. The scientific definition for neuroticism is very similar to the way we use it in everyday life. So I define neuroticism as the extent to which people tend to get easily and frequently upset or distressed, and they get to get overwhelmed. So if you have a lot of tendency to get anxious very frequently, we call that highly neurotic. And at the same time, the opposite would be if you're calmed, even-tempered, you feel secured all the time, that shows a low level of neuroticism. So we theorized, and we're expecting that highly neurotic people tend to show higher level of social network addiction. And the reason, the arguments we provide for this is that getting anxious a lot, getting overwhelmed a lot, or having this feeling of worriness all the time is a negative feeling. And in order to remedy these negative feelings, and somehow in order to even escape from them, people tend to engage with social network sites. And it's an effect that is related not just to social networks. I think we can just even generalize it to use of internet. So people tend to engage themselves, immerse themselves with technology, and through that they kind of hope that they forget about all the negative feeling that happens. Or, for instance, another thing that's related to neurotic people, they may tend to show some sort of social anxiety, although these are different phenomena, but they're kind of correlated. So they're anxious of face-to-face meetings. So social network is a suitable platform for them to communicate with other people without having to face them directly. So all of these help to us coming to a conclusion that neurotic people tend to show higher level of social network addiction. And based on the results we got from an analysis of these 300 college students, we found that indeed that is a relationship that exists.
Of course, none of us are just one of these five personality traits. We all have some varying degree of each of these five. Mm-hmm. And you found that they interact, in particular, that neuroticism and conscientiousness, that differing combinations of those two personality traits can be really important in determining whether someone is likely to develop a social media addiction.
That's right. I think that's one of the novelties of this study that we conducted. So we looked at the interaction or the moderating effect of these factors. For instance, conscientiousness is about how hardworking and organized you are and how much you can put efforts in order to reach your goals. So conscientiousness obviously can have a negative relationship with addiction. So if you're organized, if you're, you know, if you can persist as goals, and if you can resist the temptations, you are less expected to get involved too much with social networks. But at the same time, our research showed that if you are highly neurotic, that can deteriorate the effect of conscientiousness.
Agreeableness was another interesting one, where people at either end of the spectrum, both highly agreeable or highly disagreeable, would be susceptible or more susceptible to addiction than people kind of right in the middle, but for totally different reasons. And you've got all of these really complicated, you know, factors going on here. And then I looked at a number of other studies related to this same question, whether they're looking at college students in other countries or looking at Americans of varying ages. And then it even gets more complex, because in some cases they find different relationships between these same five personality traits and social media use, in some cases completely opposite reactions. So how do you interpret that, and where do you think we are in having a clear picture of how personality relates to a person's susceptibility to social media addiction?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and also observation. So we were facing the same complexity when we started this study. And when we started with Big Five personality factors, that is a very common, well-established framework. So it shows a range of personalities that people might show. And for instance, the other two factors that we actually tested in this study, but we couldn't find any at this, I would call, linear relationship, where openness to experience or extroversion. I think extroversion is something I've personally experienced. And I have, beside this study, I also have interviewed maybe more than 200 people with regard to use of a smartphone, social networks. And my own observation has showed that, for instance, we tend to think that social network might be an environment for people who are introverts, who are shy, who fear, you know, real life interactions, and they might just go at social network and they just want to communicate with people and connect to people using that and just satisfy those social needs, which is something that indeed happens. I remember, like, when I was talking even to some of these college students, it was like, oh, I remember that high school friend that we had, and he or she would never talk to people, but now I see her on social networks, and she has so much to say. Like, every day she's just posting and like commenting and doing this and that. So introversion seems to be having a relationship with addiction. At the same time, extroversion can have the same relationship too. So people who are highly social, people who tend to be warm and outgoing and adventurous, those are people actually end up doing so much with social networks too, including posting and like photos and sharing their life events. And if they go to party or something, they also tend to, I would call it like overshare too. The way I see some of these factors, I do not see a typical or well understood linear relationship. So I would see a non-linear relationship. Although we haven't tested that in our study in order to have any claim, but I'm expecting that yes, the extreme personalities might have direct positive effect with addiction. They would increase chances of addiction, but I think people with moderate personality might be better in terms of controlling that. That it would be different in terms of conscientiousness. There's an element of conscientiousness that is about resisting temptations, and I think that resisting temptation would be an enough factor that will stop those addictive habits to develop.
Given all this complexity and the fact that we can't necessarily just go out and change our personalities, how do you see this information and this growing understanding of the relationship between personality traits and social media use? How do we actually put that into play and do something with it?
That is a good point. It is indeed true. I mean, a lot of studies have shown that your personality either will not change at all or modify over a long, long term in your life. The way we define and the way we identify some of the practical implication of this study is that, of course, you can't really change your personality, but if you are aware of the type of personality that you have, and if you are aware of the category that you're fitting in, first of all, you need to be more mindful of your online activities. You might need to do more monitoring. I have other studies recently conducted that I'm currently working to analyze those results. And in those studies, we collaborated with this team of software developers from UK, and they have developed an app in order to tell users how many times a day they unlock their phone and also how much time they use it during the day. And we found that actually, I mean, we're still analyzing those results, but our early analysis showed that, for instance, the more you're aware of how many times you're actually interacting with your phone, you're going to be more aware of the way you're using it. For instance, I've had people who came to me and I said they had no idea that they were using their phone over 200 times a day. But if you can actually set some those reminders or if you have an app that can highlight those numbers and highlight their behavior or highlight the negative consequences, that is something that they can develop some strategies to control it.
That is Isaac Vagefi. He's an assistant professor at Binghamton University in the School of Management. Isaac, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.